This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Peter Singer, Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University. Peter Singer is the author, co-author, or editor of more than 30 books, including Animal Liberation, Practical Ethics, and One World, Ethics and Globalization. In 2005, Time magazine named him one of the most 100 influential people in the world. Peter Singer is here today to tell us about his most recent book, The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
What led you to write your book, The Life You Can Save?
It's an issue that I've been working on since, really, I was pretty much fresh out of graduate school, so since the 1970s. I've written several articles about it, and it's featured as a chapter in a couple of my earlier books. But I thought that the time had come to really deal with it at book length, partly because that first article that I wrote has given rise to a lot of discussion, and I wanted to comment on some of the objections that have been made, and also to really address the question of, is this an idea that somehow can get out there in the world that people could act on a large scale, so that we really could, as the subtitle of the book suggests, end world poverty, or at least end large-scale, mass, extreme poverty.
How do you define poverty?
I use the World Bank's definition, which is not having enough resources to provide for your basic needs or those of your dependents, or at least not to provide reliably for them. So it means not having enough income to be sure that you can have enough food on the table, to have safe drinking water, to have shelter, of course. Also, basic needs here includes being able to provide at least some education for your children and perhaps at least a minimum of health care. Now, the World Bank currently says that to be able to provide for your needs, you need to have income that is the equivalent in purchasing power in your country of what you can get for $1.25 in the United States. So it's a very minimal amount of money. It's not even $1.25 in cash in your country. It's the purchasing power equivalent. And the World Bank says there are currently 1.4 billion people living below that line.
In what parts of the world are most of those in extreme poverty located?
The largest number are still on the Indian subcontinent, in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. But as a proportion of the population, the largest proportion is in sub-Saharan Africa. And those two places probably account for the bulk of the world's extremely poor. But there are smaller numbers in Southeast Asia and East Asia, in Central Asia, and even some in some of the former Soviet satellites.
Would anyone in the U.S. qualify as being in extreme poverty by your definition?
Well, not unless they had particular personal problems, because really people in the U.S. have access to things like food stamps to get enough calories. Of course, they all have access to education for their children. And if you are poor, then you're eligible for Medicaid, so you can get some medical attention. You wouldn't be turned away by a hospital emergency room. So the people who really would be extremely poor are people who, for some reason, can't access this system, and that may be, mental health problems, for instance, or alcohol abuse.
From an ethical point of view, how would you characterize humanity's current response to world poverty?
I think that it's woefully inadequate. When we consider that we have more than a billion people living in affluence, and even taking into account the present economic downturn, most of those billion really have lives where they think nothing of spending money on all sorts of things that are just not necessary by any stretch of the imagination. We just sort of never think about expenditures like buying bottled water or going to a coffee shop for a coffee or buying a can of soda. When we do that, we're spending as much as some of these people have to live on and even to feed their families on for an entire day. And yet we give very, very little to help these people. I think a lot of Americans don't realize how little our country actually does.
Is it wrong not to help?
I believe it is. I believe that we ought to be doing at least a kind of a decent minimum to help others to get the basic necessities. If we have so much that we spend, you know, more than they have to live on quite frivolously, then it's not going to be difficult for us to make a significant difference in their lives. And so I think we do have an obligation to do that.
In your book, you argue that to be good people, we must give until if we gave more, we would be sacrificing something nearly as important as the bad things our donating can prevent. Would you elaborate?
Right. Let me just say that, you know, that's a very demanding standard, what you just read there. And it's what the argument at the beginning of the book comes to. You're right about that. But by the time you get to the end of the book, I start to think about what would be a publicly realistic standard. And so, in a sense, the book has two standards. It has this very demanding standard that you might say the logic of the initial argument leads us to. That the demanding standard is essentially saying, look, if it's a choice between spending something on yourself that you don't really need and saving the life of a child who might die from diarrhea or malaria, easily preventable or curable conditions, then surely a child's life must outweigh the pretty trivial things that we spend money on. And that argument can get repeated until you have nothing left to spend on those trivial items. But I recognize that that's too tough for people really to live up to. And so by the end of the book, I propose a minimum standard, if you like, which I think we could make into a public standard that we expect people to meet up to. And I'm not suggesting compulsion or coercion, but something that we say, look, if you want to live an ethical life, you have to at least meet this minimum standard. And I discussed then in the last chapter what that minimum standard might be.
Following up on the more rigorous standard, how much do you choose to give to your own children versus children of others who are in dire poverty?
I think that we are obviously going to give some preference to our own children. We're going to make sure that their basic needs are met. We're going to make sure also, for instance, that they can get a decent education. It doesn't necessarily have to be the absolutely top-ranked education, but at least a decent education and a good start in life. But I don't think we should go beyond that. I think the needs of others are such that they must come into it somewhere, and sort of indulging every desire, every want of our children at the cost of not helping others would be wrong and probably wouldn't even be good for our children anyway, because I do believe that there's a point at which your children have to make their own way in the world, and the idea that they're going to get everything from their parents is not going to be a good thing for them.
Would you also discuss the tendency towards giving close to home rather than in countries that are far away?
A lot of people say, you know, well, look, we have poor here, we have homeless people here, shouldn't we help them? The stand that I take on this is that human lives are equally important wherever they're being lived, whether they're being lived in Seattle or in Bangladesh or Mozambique, they're equally important. So if I have a certain amount that I'm prepared to give, let's say, I mean, if you're earning $50,000, the average American salary on the scale that I put forward, the minimum public scale, you should be giving at least 1% of your income. So you have $500. If you ask yourself, well, where should I give that? Then you might say, look, for $500 given to someone or given to an aid organization that's working against diarrhea or something like that, putting in sanitation or safe drinking water in villages in Africa, you could really make a big difference to a family. You could maybe even save a child's life. $500 helping the homeless in Seattle probably isn't going to go very far. It's not enough to really make a difference. So that's why I would choose putting it where it goes further. And at least for the moment, that's going to be putting it in the developing countries abroad rather than here.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Peter Singer, the Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University and author of the book, The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. To what extent does the U.S. currently contribute to alleviating world poverty if you take into account both governmental and private contributions?
We're really not very good. A lot of Americans believe that this is a very generous nation. Some believe that it's bearing the largest share of helping the poor. But even when you add in government and private contributions, The best estimates that I can get suggest that maybe we're giving about 30 cents in every $100 that we earn in aid to the poor. And probably even that's a bit of an overestimation because the official aid that we give doesn't all go to the poorest people. But let's say that it's 30 cents in every $100. Well, the United Nations many years ago set a target of 70 cents in every $100. So we're not really even at half of that target. The world average just for government aid, without even the private aid coming in, is 45 cents in every $100. So even adding in our private aid, we're way below the world average just for official aid. The best nations like Sweden and Norway and Denmark and the Netherlands, give pretty close to $1 for every $100 they earn. So we're only at about a third of what they're giving. So really, we're doing pretty poorly by world standards.
And where is most of our aid focused geographically in the U.S.?
It tends to be focused on countries where we have some political interests. And that's one of the reasons why, as I said a moment ago, it's not all going to the poorest nations. So the top recipient of U.S. aid for the last few years has been Iraq. Iraq is not one of the poorest nations of the world. Of course, we've made a bit of a mess in there with our military intervention, but they have the world's third largest oil reserve, so they're not really a poor nation. The next is Afghanistan, which is a poor nation, but obviously the reason it's up there on the list is, again, because of the war against terror. The third is Egypt, not one of the poorest nations either, really, but an important partner in the Middle Eastern peace process. If you look at other regions, the Latin American nation that gets the most U.S. aid is Colombia. It's not the poorest of those nations either, but it's very important to us in terms of our fight against the drug trade, against cocaine. So that's why we're giving a lot of aid to Colombia. So, you know, our aid has very mixed motives, and I really think it would be better if we targeted our aid at helping the world's poorest, and if the U.S. wants to give other sums to other nations to help them stay on our side politically, that's a different matter and shouldn't be classified as aid.
Would you comment in your book on why you have chosen to focus on individual rather than governmental aid?
I focus on individual because it's individuals who I hope will read this book, and I want them to realize that they can do something. They don't have to just say, oh, I think the government should do more. They don't just have to say, well, I'll write to my congressional representatives. Of course, that's a good thing to do. It's good that our congressional representatives should hear from us and say that we support foreign aid, we support more foreign aid, but we want it to be targeted more to the poorest people in the world. But I don't think we should feel that just doing that is enough to get us off the hook. I think we really have a moral responsibility to do something ourselves, to open our checkbooks or to go online with our credit cards and give according to this scale that I suggest, which, as I say, starts off for most middle-class Americans at 1% and then goes up as we go up the income scale, depending on how much you're earning.
How much money is needed to raise everyone above the poverty line and end world poverty?
Jeffrey Sachs, who's an economist at Columbia University and did a United Nations report on this, he wasn't asking how much would raise everyone above the poverty line, but he was looking at the Millennium Development Goals, which were goals set and signed onto by all the world's leaders in the year 2000 at the Millennium Development Summit. And they include halving the proportion of the world's population living in poverty. And Sachs estimated that it cost about $189 billion a year to achieve that. The goal was set at 2015, so it's not very far away anymore now. But $189 billion may sound like a lot of money, but it's not really such a huge sum. The United States alone spends about $115 billion on alcohol. So, you know, just that would almost do it. And of course, the $189 billion would come from the world as a whole, not just from the U.S. So we could very easily meet our share of that commitment. It wouldn't really make a big dent in what we're spending.
Would you say more about who should pay to alleviate world poverty?
I think everybody who's affluent enough to be able to spend on luxuries, even, as I was saying before, minor luxuries like buying bottled water or a can of soda or a beer or a glass of wine, they're all luxuries by world standards. And anyone who can afford that should, I think, be prepared to give something. So the sliding scale I have starts at 1%, and then if you're in the top 10% of U.S. taxpayers, which means if you're earning $105,000 or above, it goes to 5%. And if you're in the top 5% of U.S. taxpayers, that's people earning $148,000 and above, it goes to 10%. And so on until, you know, if you get to the super wealthy bracket, it goes to 33 1/3%, a third of what you're earning. And I think that, you know, that's a scale that's really reasonable to ask everyone to give. No one will be sacrificing a decent standard of living or anything like that. And it would raise far more, when you add that up, it would raise far more money than that $189 billion that Sachs mentioned.
What do you see as the obligation of the U.S. compared to the world as a whole?
Well, I think our obligation should be in proportion to the size of our economy. Our economy is just a little under a third of the world's economy. So, you know, we should be giving something like 30% of what's needed in the world as a whole. And we could easily do that. I mean, the scale that I mentioned would yield more than that. So it's not a difficult thing for us to do. It's not something that would require a lot of sacrifice for us to, certainly to give enough to meet the Millennium Development Goals. That would be, say, a total of $60 billion, something like that, which would be roughly a little more than doubling, not quite a tripling of the total aid, including private as well as official aid that we're now giving. That's something we could really easily do.
Does an individual's obligation end with contributing their fair share, according to your sliding scale?
I think individuals who contribute their fair share on that scale have made a good start and can feel reasonably satisfied that they are contributing. And incidentally, if I could just mention, I've set up a website which has the scales. It's thelifeyoucansave.com. And I want people to actually go online and pledge to meet that scale, because I think that the more people see that others are doing this, the easier it will become. You know, I want to really create a different standard, a different norm for people to do that. But I wouldn't say that ends their obligations. For one thing, I think that some form of civic engagement is important. So I'd like them to write to their representatives and talk about making USAID more effective. I'd like them to talk about what they're doing with others so that other people can see what they're doing. And, you know, maybe gradually they'll work up to a higher level than that minimum scale. But that's a good start. That, as I say, I think once people are doing that, we shouldn't be hard with them. We shouldn't be blaming them. We should be perhaps encouraging them, but congratulating them on having taken that important step.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Peter Singer, the Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University and author of the book, The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty. What most stands in the way of people donating to end world poverty?
There are psychological barriers that we have to donating, which I think make it harder for us to donate to ending world poverty than perhaps to helping a child who we might see in our neighborhood who's in trouble. And I imagine in the book I talk about a child who's fallen into a shallow pond and needs rescuing. And I think if you could do that without any danger, we would all do it. But although there are children who need rescuing in the world, in fact, millions of them, we are less likely to help them because we don't see them. We don't identify with them as individuals. We don't give them a face. And that's one of the barriers. Another important barrier is that we focus on the size of the problem and it makes us feel powerless because we think about the fact that whatever we do, there will still be millions of children in need who are dying from poverty every year. But we should focus, I suggest, on the good that we do rather than the good that we can't do. And even if we just help one family each year, help them to have a decent life, a life that's at least got the basic minimal compatible with a reasonable human existence, that's a terrifically important thing to do. And if we can do that for $500 or so, we should be proud that we've done that, and we shouldn't just, you know, feel guilty about the fact that there are so many other people that we can't help.
What is the best way to use the money given to alleviate world poverty? What do you think would be most effective?
There's a big debate going on about what's the most effective way of giving aid, and that's as it should be, because we need to try out a lot of things. We need to experiment. I think that there are some agencies that are highly effective where you can be sure that your money will be well used. I've been a supporter of Oxfam America for a long time, and I continue to support them. They both do sort of development grassroots work in the villages, and they also help to empower people to be advocates for themselves. So, for instance, if there are mining companies that go into an area and basically ignore the interests and needs of the local people, Oxfam would help the local people to get organized to have a kind of campaign for justice and respect for their rights. So there are perhaps a more politically daring organization than some of them, and that's one of the reasons that I support them. I also support an organization called GiveWell, find it online at givewell.net, that is trying to improve the efficacy of aid. It's trying to encourage aid organizations to be more transparent and to demonstrate that what they do is effective. And I think that's an important mission, to raise the level of effectiveness of aid.
Well, you've been alluding to this, but how can we go about creating a culture of giving?
One of the things is giving ourselves and then talking about it, because the more people who do that, the more it will make it easier for others, and we'll get a kind of a virtuous spiral going where it becomes more normal, it becomes easier, more people give. So I think being public about it, encouraging others to think about the issue of world poverty and doing something about it is an important part. I'd also like to see big corporations playing their part. I'd like to see them encouraging their employees to give by matching what their employees give and other ways of encouraging their employees to give. And I think we ought to be quite open and public in our criticism of people who live lavish lifestyles without doing anything significant for the world's poor. That's just wrong, and we should say that it's wrong.
Would you mention a couple of the specific examples of people that you talk about in your book who have gone out of their way to give?
Sure. I talk about members of something called the 50% League. That's a league that, to be a member of, you have to have given away either 50% of your wealth or 50% of your income for the last 3 years. And there are a number of people who are members of that league who I talk about in the book. Some of them are people who are wealthy and have given away millions. Some of them are people who are really just on average incomes. And it's amazing how they can give away half of what they're earning and still have a good life. And in fact, they often feel that their lives have been enriched and are made better by their giving. So even though they're giving at a very substantial level, it's not a sacrifice to them. I also talk about a man called Zell Kravinsky, who made a fortune in real estate, I think about $40 million, and gave away virtually all of it, and lives very modestly with his family. And then when that wasn't enough, he heard that there were people dying in Philadelphia hospitals while on the waiting list to get an organ transplant, a kidney transplant. So he donated one of his kidneys to a stranger so that she could live. So that's a remarkable degree of altruism. I don't know that we can all aspire to that, but it is inspiring to have those kinds of examples.
What do you think inspires these special altruists?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, I think Zell Kravinsky, who I know quite well, is really just struck by the idea that he could save many lives with the money he had, and that, you know, he couldn't see that he could value his own life at so many times more than that of other people. So that's what inspired him, just this basic sense of the equal importance of every human being's life to him or herself. Other people, I mean, some of them have a religious inspiration, but some of them are quite secular. Some of them feel that they were just lucky to have the wealth that they have and that others were not so lucky and therefore they don't really deserve it, so they should share with others. And for others, it's just a matter of making their own lives more fulfilling. There are people who say that for many years they worked hard, they made a lot of money, but they never really felt satisfied or fulfilled. In a way, they didn't know what they were doing it for. It just seemed to be the thing to do. You could make money, so you did make money, and you tried to make more money. But once they started giving, then it gave them a purpose in their life. It made them feel fulfilled, and they had richer, happier lives as a result.
How can our listeners find out more and become involved?
Well, obviously, buying the book, The Life You Can Save, is one way of doing that. And going to the website, thelifeyoucansave.com, is another, because that has some of this information. It also has links to some of the organizations that I would recommend that people might consider giving to. And I'm encouraging people to go online and join. We have a Google group, discussion group set up, and create fora where people can discuss this and share with others what it is that they think about this, and in particular people who are giving can talk about their giving and encourage others to do it and discuss to whom they give, why they find it a good thing. I believe building up that kind of community of givers will be an important step towards making this a culture of giving.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
The basic message is that it's quite easy for you to make a life or death difference to at least one family in a developing country. And if that's something that's easy for us to do, then surely if we want to think of ourselves as ethical and decent people, that is what we should do.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. It's been great talking with you and with your listeners.
We have just been speaking with Peter Singer, the Ira W. DeCamp Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University and author of the book, The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty, published in 2009 by Random House. For more information, check on the web at www.thelifeyoucansave.com. Again, that's thelifeyoucansave.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.